The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good morning. You have joined We the People Radio with Aaron, Bill, Bob.
Morning, Aaron. Morning, Bob.
Morning, Bill. Morning, Aaron.
Why do we always say Bill? Why do we have to say it like that?
I don't know. It's almost either. Like Newman.
Newman.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, how's
everybody
doing?
Bill.
Hello, Bill.
There you
kinda
go.
Kind of drag it out and have that, you know, disdain.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's kind of a little chaotic this morning.
Yeah, it's a little hot, too. Our AC was off. I think our AC got flipped to heat last night.
Oh, man, it's evil.
Yeah, that's all right.
Well, while Bob calls the ambassador, we will tell you about the ambassador because we only have him for an hour. So we're going to pile on this hour. If you'd like to read more about what's going on, you'd like to join us on the chat room, wethepeopleradio.us, and Robert has a great page up with all the good stuff for this morning. So the first hour here from 8 to 9, we have Ambassador Francis Rooney. He served as the United States Ambassador to the Holy See. And for those of you that don't know the Holy See, that's the Vatican and the Pope. That's the Pope. Under George W. Bush from 2005 to 2008, he's the chief executive officer of Rooney Holdings Incorporated. His new book is called The Global Vatican. And Ambassador Rooney provides an unprecedented look inside the Catholic Church, its role in world politics and diplomacy, and the extraordinary relationship between the United States and the Holy See. It's a topic, I guess, that most people, I guess if you're not Catholic, you don't really
know.
Well, you don't necessarily follow what's going on in the Vatican other than when Pope John Paul passed away, then we had the election of the Pope, and that's always something that brings a lot of people forward, take a look at what's going on in the church and the traditions and those kinds of things. And I've been to the Vatican, and it's a neat place, and I'm jealous. I can't imagine if you're the ambassador, you get to go to all the fun things.
I remember when Nancy Pelosi went and embarrassed us all. That was fun.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I tried to forget about that.
Yeah.
So do we have Ambassador Rooney on the line?
He's here.
We do. We got everybody situated. We finally got everyone in the studio sitting down. We have our computers up. Holy cow. Ambassador Rooney, we gave people a little bit of a sneak peek at your biography, but we didn't tell them any of the good stuff. We left that all for you.
Although there's good stuff.
Although our good friend Stephen Manfredi, he gave us a list of like 10 possible questions, and I thought, well, we're going to need him here.
Hey, you gave away my secret weapon.
Several hours.
I was going to ask questions and make it sound like it came off the top of my head.
Yeah, well, that's over.
Be all smart.
That's over. But you know, the one thing in the questions that we didn't know was that in your book, The Global Vatican, you said that full diplomatic relations with the Vatican were only established by Ronald Reagan in 1984. I don't think most people would know that.
Now, prior to that time, you know, the conditions in the United States politically were not acceptable to doing that. You know, the anti-Catholic prejudice that I try to write about in the book that began in the early 19th and late 18th centuries, right after the foundation of the country, kind of culminated with the election of President Kennedy. And after that, it started to go down, and then you had the obvious rise of Pope John Paul as a major power player against communism, and Ronald Reagan could leverage that.
And then were you there during when John Paul was, when he passed away and then Pope Benedict was elected? Were you there at that time or just after?
Just after.
Okay. All right. Yeah, we went to the Vatican, my mom and I. We were there 2 weeks, I think, after Benedict came in. So.
Okay.
We were never there prior, but boy, there was sure a footprint left.
Oh, yeah. I was at the State Department studying Italian the day Pope Benedict was selected.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So now, when you're the ambassador to the Vatican, how much time do you spend at the Vatican? Do you spend most of your time there, most of your time here? Or?
No, mostly full-time. It's a full-time ambassadorial post. just like any other embassy to a secular country.
So you're there most of the time, huh?
Oh, yeah, other than coming back to the United States to see the kids or
for
a little vacation or something, yeah.
Okay, that's pretty fun.
You know, the anti-Catholic sentiment in the United States, I know it's where did it start? I mean, or why did it start, I guess? You know, they are the largest, or one of the largest religions in the world, and I guess I don't understand how that got started in the United States.
You know, Bill, that's an interesting question because, and I tried to outline it in the book, Maryland was founded as a Catholic colony, you know, kind of like Rhode Island was a Congregationalist one,
right.
And Virginia was kind of an Anglican stronghold. A lot of the colonies, leaders of the colonies, brought their particular faith, majority faith with them, and Maryland was founded to be a Catholic state, and it didn't take more than about 60 or 70 years before the anti-Catholic prejudice that resulted from the Enlightenment took over, and as I wrote in the book, John Carroll and his cousin Daniel, who signed the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, were unable to vote in their own state by 1776.
Wow.
I think it had a lot to do with the Enlightenment scholars, you know, John Locke, Rousseau, Voltaire, who were repulsed by the church because of its alignment with the monarchies of Europe, and they were anti-monarchist at heart. And so what I try to show in the book is that they were anti-monarchists and they rejected the church in the late 1700s and mid-1700s, even though their teachings are almost word for word what the church had been preaching and teaching since the time of St. Thomas Aquinas.
Interesting.
And so why that long standoff, I guess?
Well, then you went from that kind of prejudice to the rise of the immigrants, you know, the Irish and Italian immigrants that came over. And, you know, immigrants are always kind of prejudiced against, and these were predominantly Catholic ones back then, either from Eastern Europe, you know, the Poles and Lithuanians that came to Chicago and Pennsylvania, and the Irish and Italians that came to the Northeast and out through, mostly the Northeast, I guess, originally. But finally, you know, it all kind of culminated with the election of John Kennedy, and you can, political scientists have graphed the anti-Catholic sentiment in the electorate, and it peaks with John Kennedy.
it's funny. I mean, who would think that we didn't have relations with the Pope? Because that's a gold mine, actually. I mean, a great Pope, especially like John Paul, who has the ability to have so much influence. I can't imagine not doing that, but there are quite a few. Stephen gave us quite a few cheat notes for you. Yeah. I guess we have really distanced ourselves, and that's what we see here. But we're not ambassadors, so what do we know? It looks like the Obama administration has very little to do with the Pope.
Well, there's no doubt that the president has conducted the most secular administration in history. At least it seems to me there's no doubt. I mean, even more than Bill Clinton. And as a result of being so secular, he certainly has had little to do or little interest with the role the Holy See can play in the world, which is a real shame. You know, previous presidents have leveraged the Holy See's voice in the world on certain areas of mutual interest. Obviously, under people like Reagan, George Bush, his father, there was more interest. But even Bill Clinton leveraged and had a more robust relationship with the Holy See than Obama.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about that is you can't really take that personal because he's not really involved with a lot of the countries throughout the world, his administration, and I think we're reaping the benefit of that now. And you look at that and compare it to somebody like Reagan, who was very involved with other countries and ambassadors everywhere, and look at where we were in the world then.
Yeah, it's a sad state.
Well, when you were there under the Bush administration, what were the primary things that you wound up doing? Like, when you look back, maybe things that we didn't hear about.
Well, the first thing was, of course, to mutate continued criticism of our engagement in Iraq. The Vatican had been a vocal opponent of the second Iraq invasion, and for some reasonably good reasons. I don't necessarily say we shouldn't have invaded, but some of the things that they were concerned about have, in fact, come to happen. Empowering Iran, helping Iran do things to Iraq that Iran wasn't able to do on its own, increasing persecution of Christians, et cetera, et cetera. So my job was to make sure that these lingering voices were silenced. And I did that by trying to build bridges to the people who were most anti-U.S. at that time and try to build a relationship that would make it more difficult for them to want to speak up against us. And that worked pretty well. And then, of course, the other thing was leveraging the Pope's strong willingness to speak up so strongly against the radical Islamicists, and trying to link that and leverage that to President Bush's global war on terror was another important facet.
So I bet you're not very happy with the way we're going now.
No. And fortunately, Pope Francis has recently spoken up against ISIS and the business about trying to establish a caliphate, and he even mentioned the just war theory, which I think is a really useful comment for him to make. That was what was cited to justify the Vatican's tacit acceptance of the first Iraq invasion, but it was also cited to explain the Vatican's opposition to the second one.
Well, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask you about that. When he made that comment here just in the last few weeks about, sometimes military force is necessary, I thought that was a huge, huge statement on the part of the Vatican.
Yeah, it's very useful. And the just war theory is similar to General Eisenhower's rules of engagement. You know, they're almost parallel when you get right down to it. They're just in different language. It calls for having a threat which is more than just the threat of one sovereign. You know, you don't go in and take out just a sovereign. You have to have a supernumerary threat, which is part of the problem with Iraq, but it's not the problem now. You need a community of nations to support the effort, not just one or two, which was a bit of a problem with Iraq too, but was not a problem with Iraq 1 or Afghanistan, and it's certainly not a problem now. And then the third thing you need is you need proportionality, which means the level of harm you're going to inflict is roughly relatively equal to the amount of harm that the aggressor's inflicting. And that was something that, you know, was why Iraq 1, you know, where once Saddam Hussein quit, we quit, instead of just mowing them all down. And the feeling was that in the second Iraq invasion, at least on part of the Vatican, that a full-fledged assault and takeover of the country was not necessarily proportional to the goal of taking out the bad guys who killed Americans in 9/11. And there's some truth to what they said in that respect. So, you know, here we have a situation that is so vile that almost any level of threat could be argued to be proportional to what ISIS and Syria have been doing to people in the last few years.
Well, yeah, because now it's about it's about every other religion other than Islam they're at war with. So
and really, half of Islam they're at war with too, because they hate the Shiite about as much as they hate us.
That's true. There's probably more Muslim victims than anybody else right now, but they are coming after everybody.
Well, and at the end of the day, one of the implicit significant enemies of Al Qaeda and ISIS is the Arab monarchies. You know, the Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Saudi Arabia, etc. And Osama bin Laden used to make that clear that he was against them, and that's part of why Saudi Arabia has behaved so strangely in many ways that we can talk about. But right now, we have this non-state actor. And my hope is that this becomes an opportunity to draw the Arab states into the direct conflict. And, you know, they're the people closest to the football field. They need to put some pads on and play as well.
Well, I think that's the big stumbling block right now. And it seems like they're the only ones that don't want to get involved directly right now. They want everybody else to come in and kind of clean up the mess. But it's their game. I mean, they're going to be the ones impacted first by letting this go. They've got huge skin in the game.
It's been the history that we've allowed them, we've enabled them, kind of like you said, enabling like a drug addict or something.
Sure.
We've
yeah.
enabled them to be passive in their backyard and to export their Wahhabism to other countries to buy peace at home, all of which is bad stuff. And Now, you know, you've got King Abdullah speaking up against radical Islam right there in Saudi Arabia and encouraging the Muslim clerics in Saudi Arabia to speak up against it too. And just last week, Abdul Aziz, who's the head imam of Saudi Arabia, said that, you know, terrorism like ISIS has no place in Islam. So there's a few good sprouts starting to spring out of the dirt here, but we've still got a long way to go.
Do you think having the Pope speak out more on this would help bring a coalition out to help, you know, fight this situation?
Undoubtedly, especially in the Western nations, the Pope, and in Latin American nations, the Pope gives huge cover to a politician whose people may be more pacifistic and not realize the threat. The Pope helps that situation out a lot. He also gives argument to the just war theory, which by calling for the community of nations, you know, creates a rationale for bringing NATO in and bringing Western Europe in and also bringing in the states closest to the conflict. I don't think there's any doubt that they can be a constructive voice here.
Right, right. Well, talk to us about the numbers. What's the numbers of Catholics throughout the world in some of these other countries?
Yeah, because it seems like lately, you know, they're... I guess I haven't noticed any difference in particularly in church attendance, but I have since I was a kid. I'm 53, and I grew up on the East Coast, and, I mean, it was shoulder to shoulder. I remember because there was no air conditioning.
You know, so you think sweaty
about,
shoulders.
Think about the summer, and it's like, if we're not there early, it's gonna be horrible. So how have you seen that play out, especially in the time that you were the ambassador?
Well, I put some stuff about this in the book. The church attendance, as you know, has gone steadily downhill in the United States and all the Western world. And our statistics are masked by the Hispanics because they have been growing and their church attendance is higher than ours. So it makes the United States look like a much higher, higher attending nation than it really is if you take the non-Hispanic Catholic population. I think there's like 1.1 billion, 1.2 billion Catholics in the world, but the fastest growing areas are in Africa and somewhat in Asia, but certainly Africa is the fastest growing. And there's even been an inroads by evangelicals in Latin America. I heard a statistic that I'm not sure of, but in Guatemala was like majority evangelicals now.
Wow. And, you know, you talk about Africa being on the grow. I mean, you would think that having strong diplomatic relations with the Catholic Church would do nothing but help us in those areas because, I mean, that's a war-torn region.
It is, and who better than the Pope with his soft power platform to speak out against
exactly.
Terrible governments like Zimbabwe and the Christian-Muslim fight in Central African Republic and the fight of everybody against each other in Darfur. Three different sets of Muslims, plus Christians, you know. I mean, the Pope's in a unique position to say, enough of all this, you know. This is totally inhumane on all parts.
Right. You know, you use the term soft power. Tell us what that's about. Where'd you come up with that?
Soft power is the power of influence and persuasion instead of coercion. You know, you use the moral force of your arguments. You use the ability to build bridges and relationships to gain understanding of other people rather than brute force. And it has a role to play in the world, and I think it has an increasingly accepted role to play now, given the nature of the conflicts that we see that are first of all, they're asymmetrical. It's not just pitch battle. And B, that it seems to have all these religious and tribal and cultural overtones, which leads right into, you know, building cultural bridges and using soft power. The State Department's recently inaugurated an initiative called cultural diplomacy to try to harness some of these similar threads and figure other ways to reach people where they can't reach them otherwise through force. We've even seen Rouhani in Iran and Putin in Russia, although I don't necessarily trust their motives, calling mm-hmm. for soft power solutions instead of arms. Of course, they're calling for soft power so someone doesn't bomb them. You know, but.
Right.
Yeah, we were being nice. What? Way to hide behind it.
Yeah.
So the term under Pope Benedict was really different. I mean, it was even different if you were Catholic in this country. He made some really sweeping changes.
Yeah, you know, a lot of Catholics feel that Pope Benedict was just extremely conservative, too conservative for the day that we live in, American Catholics, okay? But when you look at him from a diplomatic point of view, and you look at his willingness to speak up against the global war on terror, and speak up with such a historical and philosophical orientation, I think he provided a useful service. Certainly provided a useful service to the administration of George Bush in leveraging the global war on terror. He also spoke up against secularism in a deep, profound way that goes back to early civilization and the role of natural rights of man and creating essential human dignity as being essential for good civic behavior that other people have not ever articulated quite so clearly. So in that respect, I really think he made a huge contribution. I tried to explain that in the book. I hope I did a good job of it.
He was probably, I'm not going to say our smartest pope in a long time, because that's a really, it's a really pejorative term, but he was very, very scholarly.
He was certainly the most scholarly and the most intellectual.
Yeah, and I think that went over. I think that went over people's heads a little bit. I think they liked the little bit more personal touch. What was he like to work with? Like, what kind of people did he surround himself with?
Well, he's a very nice, gentle, kind, pastoral person. Not at all unlike the way the media portrayed him up front, but. He wasn't a great administrator, and how many philosophers are great administrators?
Mm.
And really, that's an issue with the papacy generally. There hasn't been a really good administrator since Paul VI, who came from a noble family, was used to families that had property and people on the payroll and, you know, checks to be cut and things like that. You know, Pope John XXIII's family were goat herders, and John Paul, you know, was from the mountains of Poland, So now it looks like we have Pope Francis, who's a better administrator than Pope Benedict. He's made some really good appointments, where Pope Benedict made some appointments that turned out to be a little disappointing, and he lost control over a couple of things like the Vatican Bank. And now I think Pope Francis is going to fix a lot of that, and he's brought in a couple of American cardinals, particularly Cardinal Worrell and Cardinal O'Malley, who are really capable in this area and can really add a lot of value in fixing these problems.
It's funny. I don't think most people really know about or understand things like the Vatican Bank.
Right. And that got me to thinking, does the United States, does the Catholic Church of the United States have much influence with the Vatican?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does. It certainly, especially right now, because if you saw the articles in the papers, at the time of the election of Pope Francis, they mentioned the big Red Room meeting at the North American College where all the cardinals were speaking out against what we needed in a pope, and I think they had a lot to do with his selection. The influence of America has always been there, but the Europeans resist it, and they try to keep it down. But even as far back as Vatican II, you know, when the European clerics who were so conservative and opposed Dignitatis Humanae and Nostra Aetate, that recognized other faiths and all that kind of stuff, it was the Americans led by John Courtney Murray, a Jesuit, and in a union with the Eastern European prelates who lived under abridgments of religious freedom, and said, you can't give religious freedom to some people, not to everybody, that got those documents approved. And so, you know, there's always this anti-U.S., pro-monarchist European sentiment that's lurking in there, but they can't get away from the fact that the U.S. gives a preponderance of the resources to the church and has a huge, second, third largest Catholic population in the world.
Do you think we'll ever see an American pope?
I'm sure we will. I think Pope Francis is certainly a good warm-up to the refreshing value of looking to the new world for leadership.
That's true. He doesn't go to old world Europe anyway. We need to take a really, really quick break. We'll be right back. We are speaking with Ambassador Francis Rooney. Kind of forgot to put that in there in the meantime. People have been listening for a half hour. I hope you figured it out. We are talking about his book, The Global Vatican, and his experience as ambassador under the Bush administration, 2005 to 2008, or the years we're focusing on. If you have questions, join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back.
What shall we do about them? Soul, then it's just your body. Then they go.
so down upon me, Jesus. You gotta help me make a stand. You just got to see me through another day. My body's aching and my time is at hand. I won't make it any other way.
Good one, Bob. See, music for every occasion. What do you play when you have the former ambassador to the Holy See on the interview? It's a little tricky.
It is tricky.
We do so much with environmental policy and lots of things like that, lots of political topics, that this almost verges on the we can't really joke around. But I guess we could. They probably joke around at the Vatican.
Those guys have senses of humor, too.
I was going to say, they probably goof off at the Vatican a little bit, don't they?
Well, in their circumscribed way. I remember when Mrs. Bush wanted to come head up the Olympics in 2005, and the White House called and said, you know, we need you to set up a private meeting with the Pope and Mrs. Bush. And up to that point, the Pope had never seen any person other than a head of state or an accredited ambassador or a large group. So I went in to see the Secretary of State, and I explained the situation, and he said, well, you know, Pope's never seen anybody like that, but let's see what we can do. And then 2 days later, we were in a receiving line with the Pope, and I go up to him, and I, you know, shake hands and whatnot, and he looks at me with a twinkle in his eye and says, I guess we're going to see Mrs. Bush, aren't we? And I said, well, if you say so, you're the boss. You know, he laughed. He just went crazy. You know, no one ever talked to him like that, I don't think.
And it's funny, you don't think of him being a funny guy, but there are a lot of pictures of him smiling, and you can really tell. You can tell he probably had a pretty good sense of humor. He was super smart.
Well, I would imagine he is pretty closely guarded, and I don't imagine it would be possible for anybody to just walk up and shake his hand.
No, this was the receiving line of the diplomatic corps. No, you can't get in there and do that. He's guarded just like the president or anybody else. I mean, the whole apostolic palace is got a fairly high security. And the guy that runs the security there, Dr. Johnny, you'll see him whenever the Pope's walking around in one of these visits. Very, very well-schooled, excellent professional security officer trained in the Italian security forces, and he just runs a fantastic operation to protect the Pope.
Well, yeah. And the Swiss Guard, I mean, those guys, my mom wanted to take a picture with one of the Swiss Guard, and they were like, no.
Well, we were talking to our local parish priest last week. He was back.
We tried to get him to sit in with us, but he had mass, darn it. We saw him last night. We're like, job. You could change your mind.
What was he there for?
The canonization.
Oh, that's right.
He was all excited. He was number 46, so he snuck into all sorts of good stuff.
Well, he was talking to us about some of the security and some of the stuff that he attended, and it really did remind me of going to an event with somebody like the president. I mean, you had to really jump through hoops, get background checks. I mean, even the priests were checked pretty thoroughly before they even got close. I was impressed.
Well, you know, there's nothing to say that someone couldn't interpose as a priest, just like they can interpose as in any other thing. In fact, as I put in the book, during the Cold War, East Germany, and I think it was the Ukraine, did in fact do that and infiltrated the Vatican.
Oh, that's not good.
And recently, you know, ISIS has said we need to consider the Pope a mortal enemy, just like the United States and everybody else. Because, you know, you think about it, when I was in Rome, the Holy See was considered one of the leading highest security risk positions because of the risk of these radical Islamists wanting to catch the U.S. and the Church at the same time.
Well, and you were there just 4 years after 9/11. So I would imagine things were still incredibly tense. I don't think that's ever really gone back.
No, we had a couple of bomb threats and a couple of people trying to get in, scale the wall of the embassy and things like that. And had a fairly high level of security.
How do you feel about the Pope not using the Pope mobile for cover when he's out amongst the masses? You think that's
really...
got
to worry about it. I hate for anything to happen to him. I mean, it's obviously stimulated a lot of people, the ability to get that close to the Pope and feel him as a human, which used to be that way with presidents and popes and everybody, and now everything's so attenuated because of security risks.
Right.
I would just hate anything to happen to him.
I know. I've seen a lot of pictures of him just right down with the people.
I know,
I bet his security people are
like,
are just on edge when he does that. But he doesn't seem to be intimidated or afraid to go out and really get right in the middle of it.
No, he doesn't.
So, Ambassador, who has the great, really great working relationship, you know, historically great relationship with the Holy See? I mean, it hasn't been us.
Well, I think it's evolved over time. Obviously, you know, in the early years of the Middle Ages and things, you know, it was kind of a constant struggle between France and Germany. And then you had the rise of England, which was important for a short time, but not so much after Henry VIII, obviously.
Yeah.
And around the same time as Henry VIII came the rise of Spain with Felipe II and the wealth of the New World. It was the wealth of the New World that actually built St. Peter's in the 16th century through Philip II of Spain. So they were hugely powerful for a long time. And now in the modern era, I would have to say the United States has exerted a fair bit of influence in the Holy See. If you read my book, you'll see that we had a very strong relationship with the Holy See all during World War II. Franklin Roosevelt realized the ability of the Holy See to be useful to American policy interests during the war, and he leveraged it by sending a personal representative there. Then, of course, the Cold War stuff took the relationship to a whole new level. And even Obama's secularism has not been able to undermine the broad respect that foreign policy thinkers and other states have for the role the Holy See plays in the world. So I think Obama's going to be a temporary aberration here.
Yeah.
It's a shame that we don't have a little stronger relationship there.
Especially with everything that's going on. I mean,
Secretary Kerry gets it, and he's made a few trips over there and to talk to his counterpart, Secretary of State Paroline.
Well, that's useful, I guess, as we head into this mess, because if we don't deal with, well, and how about Israel, I guess, before I forget that, because the next hour we have a guy on who is part of the global security, he does global security work, but specifically he works with Israel. He is from Israel, and last week he called us, gave us a little update from his Humvee on the border of Gaza, so... You know.
Well, the Middle East is hugely complex, and the Israeli Palestinian aspect of it is no less complex than Sunni Shiites or anything else. I mean, you know, the Pope's trip to Israel was groundbreaking in the sense that he went to Jordan, and then he went to Bethlehem, and he went to Israel. I don't think other popes have ever had a multi-stop visit when they went to call on the government of Israel. And I think it was controversial in Israel, and the Pope did some things that were controversial that we could talk about. But I think it was healthy that he went to Jordan because, you know, Jordan's kind of become the stepchild of the United States in this Middle East, in this Syria-Iraq situation. And it would be a horrible shame for Jordan to become undermined and weakened because of the tons of refugees that have fled there from Iraq and Syria and because of the number of bad guys that are probably lurking around in some of those refugee communities. King Abdullah is a huge ally of the United States. And so that was good. Now, then he went to Bethlehem. And that was theological, you know, the birthplace of Jesus. Then he went and kissed the wall between Israel and Bethlehem. The wall's been a source of great consternation for Palestinians and Christians because the Christians happen to all live in Palestinian areas, and a lot of them in Bethlehem. And it's hard to get back and forth to Israel. But on the other hand, you look at the number of suicide bombers that wall has repulsed. You've got to say that a little inconvenience might not be so terrible to make sure that more innocent people aren't killed by radicalized Islamic suicide bombers.
True story.
How was he received when he went over there, went to Israel? Up front, I think what everybody sees, he was received with open arms. But how was that? I mean, was it a little chilly?
Well, I think he was received well. I mean, except for, I mean, maybe privately, you know, that he might have been spoken with by Naya or somebody about the Jordan and Bethlehem wall situation. There was some press in Israel against his stopping at the wall and saying a prayer. not the Wailing Wall, but the wall between Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. And then subsequent to meeting with Netanyahu, I think it was that last day when he went and met with the imam at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, I think that definitely steamed up the Israelis a little bit.
But not doing that just leaves the door open for more problems. How much of a you know, if the U.S. and the Vatican really teamed up and really, you know, really put their best foot forward, let's say, what's the potential?
Well, I think the potential is to have the Holy See influence some people that the U.S. can't because of its position, and I think the potential is for the U.S. to take the Holy See's message and deploy it in a more tangible way, as is the potential for Israel to do it. You know, I mean, I would say to Israel about the Al-Aqsa Mosque visit, you can't visit with him, so why not have the Pope do it? You know, look at how the Pope Benedict spoke up bluntly against radical Islam and brought a bunch of Muslim clerics out of the woodwork who basically admitted that Islam's got to come into the modern world and can't live in the 12th century, you know, that we're not going to go back to the Stone Age just to suit them.
And that truly is what they want. And looking at what's going on lately, I just, nobody can support
just
that.
Just doesn't make sense.
Nobody really can support any of that.
Yeah. See, I think the Pope and his emissary to the Middle East, Archbishop Filoni, who used to be the Holy See's ambassador to Iraq, so he's very knowledgeable, I think there's a role they can play in meeting with people that it obviously certain states can't do in an open way in that area.
Does Israel have an ambassador?
To the Holy See, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have a strong. I had a very strong relationship with my counterpart from Israel, and we worked on many things together, especially during the 2006 Lebanon War.
That's right. I forgot about that one. So in order to become the ambassador and go there and, you know, be able to do a good job, what were you doing prior?
I was running a group of international companies. We have a group of companies that work in Latin America and Central America, the United States, and I've always been involved in Republican politics, knew President Bush, and there been some things in the first administration for him, some official visits to different things, and a couple of commissions and here and there. And so, come the re-election, he offered this position, and I was really thankful for the opportunity to serve him.
I bet it was amazing. I mean, what an amazing place to get to see the inside. What was some of the stuff that you didn't expect?
Well, I think I didn't know enough about what to expect or not expect from the local priests that are working in the Secretary of State's office. But what I found was they were incredibly knowledgeable. I mean, you know, they're organized just like our State Department with various desks of. Each different Monsignor has a responsibility for countries the way our desk officers do. And they're incredibly knowledgeable about what's going on all around the world, all the nuances of policy issues in each of these countries. And they do it with a very small staff. I was amazed at that. And I was also really thankful to learn that a lot of these guys who are involved in their foreign policy apparatus are just as pastoral and everything as a great parish priest, and many of them will probably just as soon be somewhere in Northern California preaching to a nice flock of Catholics that are doing what they're doing. But they consider this the use of the talents God commissioned them to deploy.
So it isn't just hardcore politics.
No, there's always a little bit of that, especially when you've got a lot of Italian clerics involved.
It almost sounded like you said we could get a lot done with a lot smaller staff in our country.
Well, I asked Cardinal Turan, who's a very senior diplomat in the Holy See, high up in the Secretary of State's office one time, how come a staff of 100 or 150 can do what it takes so many more people in the State Department to do? It's not that anyone's more intelligent than the other. It's just that, as he said to me, well, we're priests. We don't have any outside distractions other than our work.
Oh, yeah,
they're 24/7 focused on whatever their part of the curia is commissioned to do.
Well, the part that we've listed on our webpage about your book, The Global Vatican, for starters, the cover is beautiful. But it says here it's part memoir, part historical lesson. And it captures the braided nature, which I thought was a great descriptor, of the religious and political power and the complexities and the battles and the future prospect. And going into this future with this Islamic, I mean, it's never been this, well, I mean, I guess we had the Crusades. It has been bad before.
Well, the new news here is that we haven't faced a religiously inspired, or at least religious metaphor inspired, force like this probably since the Crusades. All of our other conflicts have been with hegemonic states or groups that wanted to become hegemonic states.
What do you see going forward? What could the U.S. do to really to help themselves? Because we're headed for something, I think, probably bad. Who's our ambassador to the Holy See right now? And what are they doing that we see?
Well, our ambassador to the Holy See is named Ken Hackett. He's a really good guy. He used to run Catholic Relief Services in Baltimore, and I think he's doing a really good job. But his job's much different than mine was, because I had George Bush, who had such serious interest in leveraging the Holy See in all opportunities and in knowing what the Holy See thought about a wide range of issues. So for me, it was very robust. I think that Ambassador Hackett is doing a great job, and he's advancing U.S. interests where he can, but it can't be as robust as it was with George Bush. I can't imagine how it could be.
Yeah. And what is it that we don't see here? That is kind of, there's always a facet of everyone's work that isn't promoted, and it's unfortunate because people miss a lot. What would you like people to know?
Well, one of the things about working in the Holy See is a lot of the best things that we do together, just like in many ambassadorial missions, are either classified or otherwise not subject to disclosure.
Oh.
And you know, there's things that we've gotten the Holy See to do for us that really can't really be described. And there's things that we've told the Holy See, information we've exchanged with the Holy See. You know, some of the stuff about John Paul II and Gorbachev and the weapons being amassed at the Polish border by the Russians and Secretary Casey coming over and showing those maps to the Pope, or Vernon Walter showing those maps to the Pope. All that stuff's declassified now, so you can get a feel for some of the things that happened, because in an attempt to bring the Holy See into these situations and leverage their network. I mean, and they do have a vast network of information that it's important for the United States to tap into and receive. They know a lot of things sometimes that we don't know through their Catholic hierarchy, NGOs, nuns, Catholic hospitals, etc.
Interesting, because you don't hear much. You know, it seems like anymore, though, the way our media does things, we don't hear about things unless there's some sort of scandal. So I guess not hearing about the ambassador is probably a good thing.
Yeah, he's working quietly and effectively in many ways. I really respect him for his service. In some ways, his job is much more difficult and complicated than mine was.
Yeah, that's true. He is bridging probably a greater divide in a way. So what really prompted you to write the book? Because it's not an easy thing to do.
No, it took 3.5 years, and as a priest friend of ours in Notre Dame said, he said, it's going to take you over 3 years, and it's going to take a lot more work than you can ever imagine. He was right about both points. But I wrote the book because I would speak a little bit when we got back about, you know, the U.S. role and the Holy See in the world and things, and I found that people really had no knowledge of the role the Holy See has played in international affairs and in diplomacy over the years. So I thought, well, maybe this is a contribution that I can make to both U.S. diplomacy and diplomacy at large, and to the respect that the Holy See has in the world, because I think their voice is important. And it's also important that people realize that the United States has a great deal to gain from a vibrant relationship with them. So those are the two fundamental macro arguments of the book.
So for people who are concerned that the Catholic Church has too much power, or that their intentions maybe you're not representative of what we would be looking for in the world. I don't happen to hold that view, but you do hear that. What would you say to those folks?
Well, I would say, you know, I did a talk at AEI here last winter, and a girl came up at the end of it and said, well, I'm an atheist. Why should I read your book?
Oh, there you go.
And I said, well, you know, if you believe in human rights, you believe in freedom, religious or otherwise, and you believe that people are endowed with inalienable right, natural rights from their creator, is the precursor of this human rights, human dignity thing, then you ought to read my book and find out that the Holy See stands for these principles for everybody, you and me. She said, well, maybe I will go read your book. So, who knows?
You probably lost her when you got to the inalienable rights from God. I think she probably drifted a little bit.
She wanted the inalienable rights. She just
she did pick up on freedom and human dignity.
Exactly.
Right.
And that is one thing that that's one thing that the Pope always stands for, and it doesn't flow with the societal whim, I guess. There's quite a bit of pushback because of that.
Right. One of the most pithy expressions of what the Holy See's diplomacy is all about is from this guy, Cardinal Tauron. I always use it in my speeches, where he said the reason we're in the diplomatic business is to oppose and contest systems or ideas which corrode the essential dignity of the human person. That gets right down to it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it does.
It does, because we're seeing, let's face it, there's a lot of discussion these days about the moral fiber, and the Pope is sort of the standard bearer for that sort of thing.
Sure. So whether you're talking about the risks of secularism to good civics over time, or whether you're talking about the heinous dictator in Zimbabwe who's ruined a good country, or you're talking about ISIS who thinks they're in the 11th century and we're trying to do a reverse crusade on us. You know, they're all the same situation in some ways.
Well, popes historically, popes fought battles. I mean, they were formidable political figures, and they weren't there just for advice.
No, and when I give a talk about the diplomacy, I mentioned that both Napoleon and Garibaldi and the unification of Italy were almost existential threats to their diplomacy for that very reason, that they were trying to wage a diplomatic presence against a government that wanted to annihilate them, and those governments were unsuccessful, as was Stalin.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Well, in the last, let's see, what are we looking at? In the last, 30 seconds, minute, something like that, what did we miss? Besides everything else that was in your book.
Well, I don't know. I'd like to also make the argument in the book that in addition to all the history, in addition to the role the Holy See has played and all that, I think it's very important to focus on the here and now, as you guys have all, Aaron and Bill have done, is the promise that this particular source of authority offers the world today. And that the more we can take advantage of it and leverage it with good intentioned Western powers and secular nations, Western or Eastern, I think that offers great promise diplomatically, and they're an important player in the world stage.
Right.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Rooney. This has been an interview with Ambassador Francis Rooney, former ambassador to the Holy See. We hope you'll join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Share the interview with your friends. It's been awesome. Thank you, Ambassador.
Yes, thank you for being on.
Thank you, Aaron and Bill.
Happy Sunday morning.
All right. Thank you.
We're going to come back and we're going to talk about Israel. So we're going to move from the Vatican to Israel. You're going to like it. Be right back with you. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Redding.